The Invocation, a novel by D. Vincent De Paolo. Prelude. Los Angeles. Schofeld warned me again. It must have been the 20th time.
Once the thunder sheets begin to sound, you must shut your eyes and not open them until it's over. No matter what you hear or feel, do you understand?
You mean, if they begin to sound, don't you, Paul? He sighed.
Very well. If they begin to sound. All five hung deliberately out of reach. Promise me, Surin, that you'll remain in your seat, eyes shut tight, and not move or look, no matter what you hear.
He scowled, subjecting me to the full force of his most disapproving conductor's glare. Yes, Maestro, I said dutifully. How many more times must I promise? He smiled, and for just a moment I glimpsed my old friend again, the one I'd met so many years earlier, the one not consumed by fear and guilt and obsession.
The hall is sold out,
he said, grimacing and pressing a hand to his upper intestine.
God, what have I done?
A knock, and then a voice issued through the door.
5 minutes, Maestro Schofeld?
Paul adjusted his tie.
You'd better get to your seat.
I stood and he laid a heavy arm across my shoulder.
Remember what you have promised.
I'll remember, Paul. But once the applause begins, I'm opening my eyes to join in your well-deserved ovation.
Don't I wish it comes,
he muttered, turning to stare at the massive score. The program read, Invocation, a summons to appear for orchestra, chorus and organ by Paul Schofeld. The Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by Paul Schofeld. Paul's face was on the cover, grizzled and severe. He'd grown into himself, hardened and thickened in the almost 3 decades I'd known him. There was something about his gaze in that photo, like a man staring into the abyss. The crowd swarming around me was electric with anticipation. Dressed either in black tie or masquerade dress, it was the New Year's Eve gala. They gave the proceedings a surreal atmosphere. That most of the masks were of stylized demons and succubi was not lost on my already frazzled imagination. Although I had attempted to placate my friend's fears, I had my own misgivings about the evening's performance. I reached my seat in the first tier with some difficulty because of my foot, a congenital defect. The orchestra had already tuned, and Paul was striding purposefully toward the podium. I had just time to notice the faint concentric circles drawn in chalk around my seat before the lights dimmed, and the first glorious and terrible chords of the invocation sounded in the brass. They seemed to tear the very fabric of reality. It was then, I think, I finally grasped the truth. My friend had indeed succeeded. Movement 1. 30 years earlier, London. It was at a concert in Duke's Hall at the Royal Academy that I first met Schofeld. It happened I was sitting next to him. A big man he was, almost overflowing from his seat, and with such a look of concentration that I dared not cough or shift in my chair for fear of disturbing him. It was a piece in the modern style for orchestra, and an unusually large percussion battery. I remember being completely drawn in by the intricacies of the rhythms, the subtle articulations of the strings, the nearly barbaric eruptions of the brass. It was almost too much for me to bear. The argument, as it were, was beyond my limited scope of comprehension, yet the challenge of it thrilled me. Unlike most modern music, which I found forced and incomprehensible, this piece had a bold, clear structure. Complex, yet not impossible to follow. It had the melodic and harmonic continuity of a symphonic poem in the late or post-romantic style. But the tonalities were far beyond anything I'd heard before, stretched so near the breaking point that one felt perpetually on the brink of an enormous precipice. Indeed, the piece was called Chasm, and I remember thinking at the time how incredibly apt it was, so much more effective than, say, Inversions, a quincunx, as was the fashion of the day. My enjoyment of the piece was diminished, however, by a recurring, extremely disagreeable sensation. A smell, thick with animal humours, almost viscous in the small alcove, had wafted over me several times during the opening larghetto. In disbelief, I'd cast a cautious glance at my neighbour. We were alone in the box. He can't be expelling such a stench, can he? And then, during a delicate pianissimo passage, I distinctly heard and then smelled the ungodly answer to my query. I tried to push it from my mind, to ignore it as one would who worked within a septic tank or the bilge of a trawler. I lowered my head and hid my nose in my collar. Yet, again and again, I was pulled out of the most glorious reverie by this horrific stench, this mephitic vapour. Finally, I could stand it no longer. I was on the verge of saying something, perhaps jabbing him in the side and suggesting he remove himself to the water closet, when the opening figures of the coda drilled themselves into my ears with such intensity that all else seemed insignificant. My mind was bound by the wonderfully furious music. Smell, touch, feel, sight, taste. None of them mattered. I felt myself brought to the very edge of understanding, pure unself-conscious awareness of time as it unwound from a vast and impassive spool, and it seemed almost as though I was writing the music there and then. Its execution and my understanding of it were that perfectly aligned. And then, after the cataclysmic finale, a literal explosion of sound which tore through the hall like the birth cry of some primordial monster, and yet was neither brash nor gratuitous but wholly succinct. The only logical conclusion to the intensely complex convergence of rhythm and line and structure, I leaned over to him, for I had come to the theatre alone and felt the need to express my amazement to someone, to anyone, even this flatulent oaf, pressing on me with an urgency all the more inflamed by the wild clapping and stomping of the crowd around me, and, to my utter astonishment, just as I said, "My God, was that not amazing?" He stood up and waved to the conductor, who was gesturing toward him, and then, still with that extremely grave expression, he bowed left then right and, leaning out, to the crowd above.
"Forgive me, did you say something?"
He gazed down at me from what seemed a very great height, one hand still waving in acknowledgement to the now standing ovation. I struggled to my feet, lurching as my foot caught on the leg of my chair. "I am stunned, truly, amazed. Did you have a hand in... Were you somehow involved with that wondrous music?" He laughed, and his whole countenance changed, blossomed, and I realized he was much nearer my own age than I'd first presumed.
"I wrote it, of course. Why? Did you not like it?"
"Not like it? I have no words. I can hardly begin to describe the rush of emotion, the intensity, the revelation. Never in life has a piece of music affected me so viscerally." He offered his hand, more like a blacksmith's than a composer's.
"Well, I'm heartily glad of it. I'm Schofield, by the way. Paul Schofield."
"Yes, of course," I said, straining under his grip. I'm Søren Ambrose." And then the door to our box crashed open and a crowd of ushers and patrons swarmed in to spirit him away. I watched him leave, perhaps the most gifted artist I had ever encountered, and I had been about to chastise him for expelling gas. A great heaviness descended upon me. It was as if this brush with greatness had imbued in me a taste for the sublime, a taste which had suddenly and irrevocably soured all else in my life. I was confused by the sudden reversal of mood, angered, even. During that final coda, I had been so close to some sort of universal knowledge, a kind of union with man, or God. And then, watching him go, I'd felt myself cast down, slapped awake out of a perfect dream, and thrust harshly back into my pitiful world, the marginal existence of an unremarkable man. And then that anguish, so vivid and intense, was itself abruptly extinguished. He had not gone 5 paces, in fact, when he stopped, turned, and with a little bow called back,
"Perhaps we'll meet again? I can be found nearly every morning at the Café Select."
It was some days later that I gathered my nerve and set out. It was my intention only to walk by. I knew the place well, much frequented by upperclassmen, a status I'd not yet achieved. However, as I made my way past, trying to use my cane casually, like a dandy rather than a gimp, a strong voice called out from just inside.
"Well, hello. Is that you, Mr. Ambrose?"
And there he was, striding through the tables with the unmistakable intention of hugging me, and perhaps kissing both cheeks in the continental style. I held out my arm preemptively and we shook hands.
"Come now, will you share a pot of coffee with me? Surin, wasn't it?"
I nodded as he continued, his flow uninterrupted.
"This is a fine coincidence. I swear I had the strangest dream about you just last night."
There wasn't the least bit of guile or disingenuousness about him, and the force of his will was so great even then at that young age that it would have taken a far stronger personality than mine to have denied him, had I wished to. He led me to a small table by an open window as he called to the bar.
"Joselito, another pot of Turkish and 2 cups, if you please."
Then, with a glance in my direction,
"And a mince pie for my friend."
I smiled down at my hands. In a town where tea or watered coffee was the norm, it was rare to find another with a taste for the true strong Turkish brew, and yet here my companion had taken it for granted. And how he knew I was famished, having spent my allowance for the week on the concert, I had no idea.
And please, Surin, you will allow me to play the host. You paid me a most uncommon compliment the other night, and I'd like to somehow repay you."
"Your music was a gift in itself, mister."
"Please call me Paul."
He enunciated each vowel of his name with such precision it added an extra syllable. Austrian, I guessed, or perhaps Swiss. I inclined my head. "Yes, of course. Paul, in any case, I'm afraid I must accept your generosity, at least for today." He waved a hand in dismissal. I shook out my napkin and began cleaning my glasses.
"It's funny, though,"
he said, running a hand over his chin.
"I'd guessed you were American."
I breathed on one lens. "Funny how? I am American. From Buffalo, in fact. In truth, I was a naturalized American, having moved there from Sweden when I was 11. But I saw no reason to share that fact." He nodded.
"Ah, Buffalo, I see."
Then, gesturing toward the insignia on my blazer,
"So, you go to university then?"
"Yes, I'm second year."
"Second year? Really?"
And there the conversation languished. He can't be interested in me romantically, I wondered. I had no bias against that sort of thing, but I racked my memory, hoping I hadn't given the wrong signals unconsciously in my excitement after the music. Then the coffee and pie were delivered by an absurdly beautiful young girl, Joselito's daughter, judging by her accent, black eyes, and even blacker mane.
"Hola, Paolo. How did you go?"
Schofield inhaled sharply, shot a glance toward the bar, and then smoothed the cotton of her skirt with a trembling hand.
"Thank you, my dear. Pray, bring us some sugar."
We both sat, breathing, as we watched her walk the length of the cafe. To my surprise, I learned he was a student as well, not at the university but at the conservatory, also under the same benevolent auspices, so obliquely we were schoolmates. He was in his 4th year, though it was chronologically his 3rd, he having skipped the 1st entirely. Though he was obviously used to being the center of attention, he showed a keen interest in me and my work, which I must admit flattered me no end. I was pursuing a degree in art history, Byzantine iconoclasm being my particular specialty, and he was quite well informed of the topic, even to the point of sharing my preference for the 1st period, 730 to 787 AD, over the 2nd, 814 to 842 AD. And so we spent a convivial morning talking of gold leaf and harpsichords, Schofield flirting with Marta, and the both of us ogling several gorgeous Danes seated at the tables outside. His concert, it turned out, had been the prize for a competition. I'd not had time to read the programme that night, having seen and registering only that Mahler's 8th was scheduled for the 2nd half, and so deciding on impulse to spend what little money I had to be transported to that fantastic world of his, as though the very heavens, the stars and planets, were vibrating as one to utter the mystic chorus of the finale. The irony, of course, was that I'd left after intermission, Schofeld's piece having so destroyed me I needed to sit with cotton in my ears and a moist rag on my forehead for much of the night. All that and more he told me, but in the most offhand way, as though his winning the contest or skipping the first year were just matters, of course, not accomplishments to be proud of. It was almost lunchtime when we parted, but I felt none of the anguish I'd felt before. Indeed, we parted as friends, and I was confident I would see him again. You have been listening to The Invocation by D. Vincent DiPaolo. Follow along with the book, available in the Kindle store. See the link in the show notes. And do stay tuned for the next chapter.